Let me just get... Yeah, hopefully we're on the home straight, and tea and coffee is coming. But hopefully all the stuff that you've heard this morning, and I think what I'm going to say, should all be weaving in together. So hopefully that will make some sense. Does anybody recognize this guy? Who is it? Close. Yep, it's Rory McIlroy. Rory McIlroy, for those of you who don't know, is a golfer. He's 22, and he came this close to winning the biggest golf tournament in the world. Now, I don't really know much about golf, but Rory went to my school. Admittedly, I left about 4 years before he even started, or maybe longer. Maybe it was 11 years before he started. But I've been, every time Rory McIlroy comes up in conversation, I keep saying, oh yeah, Rory went to my school. And the reason why I do that is because for some reason I want to take a little piece of Rory's fame and kind of his significance and take it for myself and go, yeah, you know, some of that's rubbing off on me. And for lots of us, we do that in lots of different ways. My wife tells me I name drop sometimes, and I think that's, you know, I like people to know that I know some people who are for something. And by doing that, it's like this way that I make myself feel like I'm something, that I'm significant, that there's something important about me. And I'm sure you know ways that you do that as well. We all want to feel significant. We all want to feel important in some way or other. And that's partly what's going on in the passage we're going to look at this morning with Jesus' disciples. They want to know, or two of them especially, want to be significant and want to have some sort of significance in God's kingdom. But Jesus is going to turn it on its head. So we've been looking at the kingdom of God over the last few weeks, the last couple of months. And again this morning we're going to look just at another kind of perspective of that. So if you could open up your Bible at Matthew 20, it's page 988. Matthew 20, verse 20. And we're just going to read, I'm going to kind of give a few thoughts and comments as we go through, so it's, I'll not read it all at once. But it starts off, and it says, "Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons," this is James and John, "and kneeling down, asked a favor of him. 'What is it you want?' he asked. She said, 'Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom.' Now, the sons of Zebedee are also called the sons of thunder earlier on in the New Testament, or in one of the other books. And they're the two who, if you remember, there's one time when Jesus and disciples were going around and James and John wanted to call down fire from heaven to burn up this village of Samaritans or of people they didn't like. So these are two guys who are not backwards. They're fairly fiery characters. And their mother comes and says to Jesus, "When your kingdom comes, when you come into your position of power and authority, can my two sons have the two most important spots?" That's what the right and the left means. So there's this thing going on with Jesus' disciples that they still don't quite get what his kingdom is about. They still don't quite get what's going on. They don't get what he's been saying to them, that he's someone who's going to suffer and die. So it goes on, and Jesus replies and says, "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink?" "We can," they answered. So Jesus is saying, can you do the cup that I'm going to drink, you know, is the cup of God's, you know, wrath, judgment, suffering, pain, all of that kind of stuff. So Jesus said to them, can you really follow in my path, follow this difficult path? And they say, we can. So Jesus turns around and says, okay, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. And when the other ten disciples, who are somewhere off in the backgrounds, hear about this, they're indignant with the two brothers. And you can just imagine, they're like, who do you think you are? You know, trying to get, the 12 of them have been going along for a couple of years, you know, and these two are trying to usurp all the others. These two are trying to get, you know, the best seats in the house. And the other 10 are raging with them and are like, who do you think you are? And probably also are thinking, why didn't we think of that earlier? I'm probably also going, why on earth are you getting your mum to go and ask for you? Are you not man enough? So the other 10 are really raging. But Jesus kind of takes this, takes James and John and their mother not quite getting what his kingdom is about, and turns it into an opportunity to try and teach them what greatness is really about, what real significance is about. You know, thinking back to those ways in which we all want to be significant in some ways. We want our 15 minutes of fame. We want to be recognized, and it's a very human thing. So Jesus turns it around and starts to teach them about what real significance in God's kingdom is like. And so he calls them together and says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. So if you're thinking about, you know, when it says the Gentiles, has anyone seen Gladiator? How many people have seen Gladiator? Yep. So every time you read the New Testament and the word kind of Gentiles comes up or Romans comes up, you have to think Gladiator, because that's the situation that Jesus and his disciples were living in. They were living under Roman occupation, this fearsome, brutal, occupying army. And when it says they lorded it over them, it kind of means like they almost crushed, you know, they were authoritarian. So the rulers of the Gentiles were people who said, you do this, and you did it. And that's the way it was. So that's the kind of form of leadership or of greatness that was seen by the disciples and that they were looking out for. And it's kind of the form of leadership very often that we see today, or the form of greatness. We see greatness or power as being something that someone has when they can tell other people what to do and they'll do it for them. But this is not the way of Jesus. And so Jesus turns around and says, not so with you. This way that the Gentiles do things, this way of power and authority, of telling people what to do and making them do it, that's not the way of my kingdom. So he says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus is saying, greatness in the kingdom of God is not about power, it's not about status, it's not about control, it's not about success, but greatness in God's kingdom is about sacrificial service, is about giving of yourself in service of other people. And Jesus himself is the example. He says the Son of Man was a name that he used for himself. Going back to the Old Testament, this idea of God's anointed ruler, he was going to come. So Jesus is the Son of Man. But as the Son of Man, as God's ruler, as the King of the universe, he doesn't choose the way of other people, of power and authority. He chooses service as the way in which he exercises his authority. So Jesus is saying the way to greatness is actually about service. And you can, I don't know if you can imagine James and John and their mother, you know, wanting these kind of the best seats in the house, now feeling kind of this high, realizing that Jesus has just turned it all around and said, no, you don't get me. You don't get what greatness is. Greatness is something very different to what you expect. And he says, greatness is about being a servant. But what does it mean to be a servant? It's one of those things that in church we talk about. Get very thirsty up here. We talk about it a lot. We use the word servant a lot, but this is me asking a question. You know, when you kind of say servant, what does it mean to be a servant? What do you kind of think of when I say we should all be servants?
Obedience.
Yep. So being obedient, yeah. Any, making tea? Yes. Yep. Yep, thinking of other people more than yourself. Yep, definitely. Yep.
Putting up with people
who are
very difficult.
Yep. Yep.
Humility.
humility. Yep. And those are all, when we think of servant, we think of those sorts of things. You know, there's the making the tea and coffee, putting out the chairs, putting up with people, all of those things. And sometimes that's what we think it means to be a servant. But I want to suggest that there's more to being a servant than just doing the things that no one else really wants to do. That actually being a servant is a much higher calling than that. Let's go back. When Jesus uses the word servant, and when he talks at the end of that passage where he talks about just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, the people, Jesus' disciples, the people who he was talking to are first century Jews. And Jews in the first century are steeped in the Old Testament, that huge bit of the front of the Bible that you sort of dip into every now and again and don't quite understand. But they knew it by heart. Jewish boys by the age of, I think, 12 or 14 had memorized Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That's a serious chunk. So they knew their Old Testament. They knew the Old Testament prophets. So when Jesus starts using this language of giving his life as a ransom for many, it evokes Isaiah 53 and the suffering servant. And so Jews are going to be thinking about, when you hear servant, you start thinking about the servant, the suffering servant in Isaiah. So there are these different chapters in Isaiah who talk about God's servant. And originally, Israel, so the nation of Israel, was supposed to be God's servant. They were supposed to be this nation, this community of people who lived life with God at the center and lived life in a way that made all of the other nations around look at them and go, wow, the way these people live, the way they love each other, the way they treat each other, the way there's no poverty, the way they honor each other, the God that they have must be incredible. Let's go and find out more. That's what was supposed to be. But as we all know, they kept getting it wrong. They kept messing up. And so that's the story of the Old Testament. These people were supposed to be this light to all the nations, but they messed up. They got it wrong. And so instead, God promised to send this person, his servant, who would do what Israel couldn't do. So I want to look really quickly at two passages in Isaiah. In Isaiah 42, it says, "Here is my servant who I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he's not going to break, and a smouldering wick he won't snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He won't falter or be discouraged." And it goes on then to say, God then says, "I will keep you and make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles." So God's going to make his servant to be a light for all the nations, the whole world, everyone in the whole world. He's going to open eyes that are blind. He's going to free captives from prison and release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. And again, in Isaiah 49, really, really similar. God talks, when he's talking about his servant, he says that, "I'm going to make this servant a light for the Gentiles, that my salvation will reach to the ends of the earth." You know, and the servant is going to say to those in darkness, "Come out," to those in captivity, "Be free." And he has compassion on them, will lead them beside springs of water. So the servant is going to be someone who sets free the prisoners. The servant is going to be someone who brings light into the darkness. The servant is going to be someone who leads people beside springs of water. Springs of water makes you think of Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." So all the stuff that Jesus talks about, there are these kind of resonances in the Old Testament. So what am I kind of saying? What is it, from all of this, what does it mean to be a servant? And I guess when Jesus is talking about servant, he's thinking about this servant in the Old Testament, this servant who is God's chosen servant, who will come and set people free. So I guess for us, as we think about what does it mean to be a servant today, what does it mean to be a servant in God's kingdom, I think that to be a servant is more than just making tea and coffee. To be a servant is more than putting out the chairs, although those are all important parts of it. But to be a servant is a really high calling. To be a servant in the way that Jesus was a servant is to help set people free from all that holds them captive, so they can be liberated to be the people that God has created them to be, so they can enjoy the life to the full that Jesus promised, so that they can enjoy the streams of living water that Jesus promises to lead us by. And that's what I kind of think it means to be a servant. To be a servant isn't just something that's small, but to be a servant is something that's actually a huge, significant thing. To set people free from everything that holds them captive. And what holds us captive? What are the things that hold us captive? It's sin and Satan in all its many forms. It might be stuff that affects us individually. It might be the stuff that we heard about in terms of thinking about Emma. Sin in its structural sense, where these girls are in a system and in a society where it's so hard to break out and break away from the evil that wants to consume them. So sin and Satan, the power of Satan, holds us captive. So those are the things that kind of hold us captive that Jesus has come to set us free from and to bring life in all its fullness. To let you think about it in another way, we have a front garden, and I have recently ventured into our garden, which was a bit of a wildlife reserve. It was just this sort of patch of green with lots of plants. Some were flowers, some were weeds. Actually, a lot of them were weeds. I think I filled 3 black bags of weeds. And I wasn't really sure what the flowers were and what the weeds were, and I've been on this journey of discovery, and this makes me sound quite old, but gardening's quite therapeutic. And so in my garden, in our front garden, there is this. Does anyone know what this is? It's a buttercup. I now detest the buttercup. This is called a creeping buttercup, and I have waged war on the buttercups in our front garden. If I had a bit more time in my hands, I would definitely wage war against them, but I'm trying. The creeping buttercup sends out these little runners, and it spreads all over the garden. So actually, about 1.5 black bin bags that I took out were this, and there's still loads of it. The creeping buttercup is poisonous. I was weeding in the garden and then got this sort of rash in my arm, and it turns out that this form of buttercup, the creeping buttercup, it gives you blisters. It's poisonous. And it soaks up the nutrients from other plants. There's a word for it, which I've now forgotten. But it has this effect that it creeps and it spreads around all the flowers and all the plants in the garden, and kind of sucks the nutrients from the soil and sucks the life from the flowers that are there. And after I'd cleared a lot of these buttercups away, I started to see little new shoots on things that I thought were dead. So there were these like little bits of sticks or wood, and I was going to pull it up and get rid of it because I thought, that's something that's dead. But after I'd cleared all the weeds away, this week there's now about 7 green shoots, little leaves sprouting up. And I guess the weeds is an illustration of the things that hold us captive in terms of sin and the power of Satan. Sin and the power of Satan are like the weeds which kind of cover our garden, which suck away the life and stop the flowers. They stop us flourishing. They stop the life to the full coming out. So hopefully that kind of, they spread over. They actually look quite nice, but in reality, they're actually sucking the life out of everything. And I guess, again, with sin and with some of the things that we struggle with, they're things that aren't necessarily bad, but taken to an extreme, they can suck the life out of everything that we have. So as we think about this way of serving that is about helping set people free from all that holds them captive to be what God has called them to be and to release them to be what God has called them to be. What are the things around us? What are the things that are holding people around us captive? Just have a think, and as you think about people in your neighbourhood, as you think about your friends and work, as you think about this community, as you think about Emma and where she's working, and think about the things like fear and debt, the expectations of others, poverty, drugs, gambling. All of those are the sorts of things that are holding the people around us captive. And what are the things that are holding you and I captive? What are the things that are stopping us from being the people that God is calling us to be? Is it fear, where we need to be strong and to be courageous? Is it addiction to things? Is it bitterness? Is it unforgiveness? Is it hurt? Is it any of those things? For all of us, there are things that hold us captive to a certain extent, and there are things which are holding the people around us captive as well. But so what does it mean, if there are all these things that hold us captive, what does it mean for us to help set people free from that? And I guess it means that we look to Jesus, because Jesus is the one who, at the cross and in his resurrection, defeated sin, defeated the power of Satan, and is now risen and exalted and reigning. All authority belongs to him, and he is the one who sets us free from everything that holds us captive, who frees us to be the people who God has called us to be. And Jesus gives us the freedom from the things that hold us captive, so that we can go and play a part in freeing other people, in freeing the people around us to be who they're created to be. And to serve in that way, to serve in this way, that's not just doing the menial things, but is actually freeing the people around us from what is holding them captive. It's costly. It's not easy. As Paddy was saying earlier, it's something that's messy, because it means that we need to get involved in each other's lives. We get involved in people's lives as we walk alongside them and stand with them in the things that they're struggling with and the things that they need to be set free from. And I guess as we look at Jesus, it cost him everything to set us free. But it's going to cost us. It will cost us our pride, because all of a sudden it means that as we seek to serve people, it becomes not about me and not about what I can get out of it, or not about us, but it becomes about the other person. It's about, what can I give to you? How can I help you to be all that God has created you to be? So just as we kind of finish, imagine what that would look like in practice. Imagine what it would look like for us as a church community of people who are people who are committed to working and praying, to helping each other be free, to helping see each other flourish, to getting rid of the weeds, to weeding each other's gardens, in a sense, and being all that God has created us to be. Imagine what this community would look like if people were set free from addiction, from the poverty that keeps them trapped. Imagine what it would be like if the power of God was released here and in the community around us. And as we do that, as we seek to follow Jesus in that, we do it in the power of his Spirit, the Spirit of freedom that he's given us. And we do it remembering that Jesus has given us all authority, and his presence through his Spirit is with us always. So as we go out from here into the rest of our week, let's be people who commit to being people who set those around us free, who are committed to being servants, who are committed to helping other people flourish. So let's just pray. And have you guys got one final song? And as the guys are playing, if there are things that you'd like some prayer for, if there are people that God has placed in your heart who you know are being held captive, who you want to see freed, come up and pray with the Prime Ministry team. If there are things in your life that you know are holding you captive that you want to be released from, come and pray with the Prime Ministry team. And let me just pray. Let's say, Father, thank you that you are the God who sets prisoners free. Father, thank you that you want us to be people who are free. Thank you that you want us to enjoy life to the full, that you want us to flourish, that you have created us to be people who live in relationship with each other, that you want us to drink from streams of living water. And Father, thank you that you've given us your Spirit, that your Spirit is a Spirit of freedom. And I pray that this morning and this week that we would know that freedom, that you would set us free from the things that are holding us captive, that are stopping us from being all that you want us to be, and that you'd help us to be people who set those around us free.